Okay, we're on lecture number 7 in our lectures on philosophy of religion. Lecture number 7. We're going to start dealing with arguments for God's existence. We mentioned a few of the arguments and put them on the board. There's some room on the board here. There's the cosmological. The cosmological argument for God's existence. This argues from the cosmos or the universe of the world that the universe itself needs a cause, or some element in the universe needs a cause. So it argues from the effect to the cause, and it argues that the universe needs a cause. Psalm 19:1 tells us the heaven declares the glory of God, and the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Also in Romans 1:18-22, I'll briefly read that. We see where Paul says that God, the invisible God, has revealed himself and made himself known through that which is visible, the creation. Romans 1, verses 18-22. And that reads, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. Since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools." And so here it teaches, Paul teaches, that the invisible God has proven his existence to us through his visible creation. It's like we didn't see the designer who designed this room, but we know he must exist because we see the visible work of his hands. Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 4 says something very interesting. "For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God." So it alludes to a cosmological type argument, and it's looking for the causes of things, and eventually it says that there must be one ultimate cause, and that ultimate cause is God. So that's the cosmological argument, the argument from effect to the cause, the universe or some element in it needs a cause. And you argue for God as the uncaused cause. There's the teleological argument for God's existence, or the argument from design. Psalm 94, verse 9, King David says something along the lines of a teleological argument from design. Psalm 94, verse 9. "He who planted the ear, does he not hear? He who formed the eye, does he not see?" And so what David is saying there is that God designed the ear. God is an intelligent designer. He designed the ear in such a way that it can hear. Surely he must be able to hear himself. He's not saying he has ears, but he's saying that the cause is greater than the effect. And when it formed the eye, he must also be able to see. And so he's saying that if we find intelligent design in the universe, therefore there must be an intelligent designer of it. Then there's the moral argument for God's existence. The moral law argues that the existence of the universal moral law, an absolute moral law that stands above all men, implies very strongly the existence of a universal lawgiver who stands above all men. Now, Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, Romans 2, Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, Paul says this: "For when Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these not having the law are a law to themselves, and that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them." And so he says that even when people do not have God's written laws, they have his laws still written on their hearts and in their consciences, and therefore all men have some idea, some glimpse of what is right and what is wrong. And from this, the Christian would argue to the existence of the moral lawgiver. Also, there's this, we're going to cover these other three in greater depth, but here's one we're not going to cover, spend too much time on. We spent a little bit of time on it, I believe, earlier in this course. But the argument from a religious experience, Geisler in your textbook gives an argument from that. And what that argues is that all men sense a need for God. Now, Matthew 4:4, Jesus said that man does not live on bread alone, but on every utterance of the mouth of God. You see, man is not just a physical being with mere physical needs, but he is also a spiritual being who has spiritual needs and has a thirst for God. In John 6:35, Jesus said that he's the bread of life, or the bread of heaven. Let me turn there so I don't lead you astray by paraphrasing what was supposed to be a memorization verse. John 6:35, Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. You come to me shall not hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst." So Christ is claiming to be able to quench our thirst for God, and that all men have this thirst for God. And the argument from religious experience is that all men sense a need for God. If there's a desire for God, it's so universal that it's obvious that Geisler would argue it's obviously something that man really needs. It's not just a desire, it's an actual need. And since if man needs something, it probably is a high degree of probability that it exists. For instance, a guy could be dying of thirst in the desert. The water does exist, though he may never find it and may die of thirst. If someone's dying of hunger, he may never get the food and he may die of starvation, but the food does exist. And even atheists such as Friedrich Nietzsche, Jean-Paul Sartre, Albert Camus, and right on down the line, even these atheists, Walter Kaufman, who refers to man as the God-intoxicated ape, they all openly admit a need for God. And so Geisler says, oh, even honest atheists admit a need for God, if there's something that all men need, then God probably does exist. How you doing, Rory? Then there's the ontological argument.
Hey, Rory, you have Geisler's philosophy of religion textbook?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Good. We're going to be looking into it real soon here.
I don't have it on me.
Oh, bummer. Okay.
The ontological argument is the argument from the idea of God, our concept of God. He's a being who cannot not exist. And a being cannot not, to say that a being who cannot not exist does not exist is a contradiction. So some would argue that by definition, God must exist. And we'll be looking at each of these arguments with the exception of religious experience. We covered that earlier in our lectures. And so we'll be touching on the cosmological, teleological, moral, and the ontological. Again, the cosmological argument is the argument from the effect, the universe, to its cause, God, the uncaused cause. Teleological argument, the argument from design, from the design of the universe to the existence of an intelligent designer. The moral argument, the argument from the moral values in the universe to the existence of an absolute moral lawgiver, and then the ontological argument, the argument from the idea of God. Now what I want us to do, I'll clear up the board, and if you can open up your philosophy of religion textbooks, we're going to spend more time on the cosmological argument than the others, but I'd like to start with the ontological argument. And so if you could turn to Geisler's chapter on it, which starts at, it's like 123. And Geisler states that that Immanuel Kant argued that the only hope for a theistic proof is to leave the realm of experience and enter the sphere of pure reason. Such is precisely what the ontological argument purports to do. Now, the reason why Immanuel Kant would say such a thing is because Immanuel Kant would say that through pure reason we can know all about the we can know reality as it appears to us, and we can know the categories, but we can't know reality as it is, the world of the senses. We can only know reality as it is to us. So he was saying that the only way to prove fully that God existed would have to be through pure reason alone. Now Kant, his thought is almost paradoxical at times, because he did believe you can prove God's existence by practical reason, but it's not so much a proof, it was a moral argument. It's not so much a proof as it is that to make sense out of our moral values, which is something we should all want to do, we should posit God as existing. So even though he did not think you could prove God's existence through pure reason, he thought that you could postulate God's existence based on practical reason. But Anselm is going to be your key figure here. Anselm of Canterbury lived from 1033 AD to 1109, the first one who came up with the ontological argument for God's existence. If you look at the bottom of page 123, Anselm argues, and we'll go refer right to Geisler's textbook there. He's got two different forms of the cosmological argument, and many of the modern adherents to this argument argue that only one of the two and so not everybody, if a guy says he holds the ontological argument, you've got to ask him which one, or does he hold the both? But most guys today only that do hold to either one of them hold to just one of the two. But Anselm's first ontological proof, premise number one, God is by definition that which nothing greater can be conceived. So the greatest possible being, the greatest being conceivable. This definition is understood by both believers and unbelievers. Premise number two, it is one thing to exist in the understanding only, and another thing to exist both in the understanding and outside the understanding. An example is a painting existing only in the painter's mind, as opposed to one both in his mind and on canvas. Premise number three, it is greater to exist both in the understanding and outside the understanding than in the understanding only. And conclusion, therefore God must exist both in the understanding and outside the understanding, i.e. in reality. If he did not, then we could conceive of one who did, which would be greater. If But God, by definition, agreed upon by both believer and unbeliever, is the greatest being conceivable. Hence, God must exist. One of the problems here is you've got Anselm with his ontological argument has you've got a God, I'm trying to draw a little diagram here. You've got the two beings, and they're just as great as each other. Okay, they have all the same attributes, but this one exists outside the mind, and this one does not exist outside the mind. That one exists only in the mind. Only in the mind. Now, Anselm is arguing that the one that exists outside the mind is greater. What many contemporary philosophers and even philosophers throughout the history of philosophy have argued is that to exist, if you got two things, let's say Bo Jackson, if you named all his tremendous athletic characteristics, and you say, let's say he was the greatest possible athlete, whether he existed or not, wouldn't make him greater or less greater. It would just say, in other words, existence would not be viewed as just a mere predicate, as a mere characteristic. What existence does is it says whether the thing that has all the characteristics, it says whether it exists or not. But it doesn't add a new characteristic. I've got certain characteristics. I've got dark hair. I've got brown eyes. I've got short legs. But then to say, and there's another characteristic I have is existence. Many of the more contemporary philosophers will say, well, you've added no new defining feature, no new characteristic to Phil Fernandez. You just stated that Phil Fernandez with all those characteristics does in fact exist. Let's see. Now, Geisler states further. Let's even go right down with Geisler's argumentation here on page 124, picking right up where we left off. This form is the way Anselm presented the argument. It conceals what later analysts feel is a hidden premise. In order to reveal this premise, the argument can be stated this way. Whatever can be affirmed, predicated of the most perfect being possible or conceivable, must be affirmed of it. Otherwise, by definition, it would not be the most perfect being possible. It is possible to affirm a real existence outside of our minds of the most perfect being possible. Hence, a real existence of the most perfect being possible must be affirmed. The same argument can be put in negative form. Nothing possible can be denied of the most perfect being possible or conceivable. Real extramental existence outside the mind, is possible for the most perfect being possible. Therefore, real existence cannot be denied of the most perfect being possible. In brief, when one begins to think or meditate on the concept of an absolutely perfect being, it is literally inconceivable that such a being could not exist. And that's what Anselm would say. Anselm's second form of the argument. Did you have something?
No, for sure.
A lot of that will go on during the ontological argument for God's existence. Okay, second form, repeating his argument, Anselm gave what some feel is a second form of the ontological argument. In summary, premise number one is logically necessary to affirm of a necessary existent what is logically necessary to the concept of such a being. Premise number two, real existence is logically necessary to the concept of a necessary existent. And conclusion, hence, it is logically necessary to affirm that a necessary existent really exists. Now, let me just read, let's just skip over the next part there. Let me, what he's talking about here is, there's three kinds of beings. Impossible beings are like square circles. They're beings that are impossible to exist. They're, by definition, they can't exist. They're a contradiction. And then there's possible beings, which is a being. Impossible beings are beings that cannot exist. Possible beings are beings that can and cannot exist. They could go either way. It's possible for them to not exist, but they do exist. Or they don't exist, but it's possible for them to exist. And then there's necessary beings or necessary existence. And that's a being that cannot not exist. And what Anselm was saying is God, by definition, is a being that cannot not exist. Therefore, it's a contradiction to say that a necessary being does not exist. Therefore, God must exist. And, of course, the complaint is going to come from a lot of people that that's just mere semantics. Let's take a look at the first paragraph there on page 125. It says, the difference between the arguments, the first and second of Anselm, is that the first form of Anselm's argument is based on predicability of existence to an absolute perfect being, and the second form is based on the inconceivability of the non-existence of a necessary being. The first form appears to be subject to some criticism to which the second is not, such as Kant's criticism that existence is not a predicate. See the discussion that follows. And what it amounts to is you have from Anselm two different ontological arguments, okay? The first one, Anselm is arguing the greatest conceivable being must have every perfection. Existence is a perfection, therefore the greatest possible being must have existence. The problem with that is guys like Kant are going to come on a scene and say he never proved that existence is a perfection. If you had two totally perfect beings, one exists and outside the mind, the other one doesn't, it doesn't mean that one is more perfect than the other, it just means one exists and the other doesn't. And so Kant's criticism, since Kant has so much sway on modern philosophy, Kant's criticism has been thought to kind of destroy that argument. But the second one does not fall to that and needs to be answered on its own ground, and that is the idea that God, pretty much it's arguing that God by definition must exist because God as a necessary being cannot not exist. And so that one's a little bit tougher to knock down, and I believe that's the one that Charles Hartshorn and people like him and Whitehead would hold to. Now, during the time that Anselm was a living, breathing human being with flesh like you and I, on earth there was a monk named Gonelil who objected to Anselm's argumentation. I'll just look at some of his objections here. Objection number one from Gonelil is the argument is built on the false premise that whatever exists in the mind must also exist in reality outside the mind. All Gonelil is showing is he just doesn't understand what Anselm is talking about here, because that's not what Anselm is saying. If anything, Anselm is saying the only thing that exists in the mind that must exist outside the mind is God, period, the necessary being. So Gonelil's missing the boat. Objection number two, if God's non-existence were really inconceivable, then no one could doubt his existence, but people do doubt and even deny it. There are atheists. Anselm's response to this is that people can doubt or deny God's non-existence, but they cannot conceive of God's non-existence. God's non-existence is affirmable, but not conceivable. In other words, people can affirm it, but not without, if they really analyze what they're saying, not without a contradiction. So, you know, a guy could, just like a guy could scream, I don't exist, I don't exist, I don't exist, and he'd be actually denying what he's affirming by the fact that he exists to make the denial. But this would be stronger because this would be, by definition, would be a contradiction here. Now, but the one I want to key on is objection number four from Gonal. This is the one that's the most famous objection, and it also misses the boat. And I'm not saying that the ontological argument is valid. All I'm saying is Gonal did not defeat it. Objection number four, Gonal said, the existence of God can no more be inferred from the idea of a perfect being than the existence of a perfect island can be inferred from the mere idea of a perfect island. In response to this, Anselm states something along these lines, which Geisler has written down, the existence of an island cannot be inferred from its idea because it is not an absolutely perfect being that by its very nature cannot be lacking in anything. The idea of an island may lack existence, but an absolutely perfect being cannot lack anything, especially being. Now, this is real similar to, I believe, an objection brought by a skeptic, Pierre Gassendi, against René Descartes, the French philosopher who also also used the ontological argument. There, the guy said that a triangle, by definition, must have three sides, but that does not mean that a triangle exists. We can know what it must be by definition, but it still doesn't leave the realm of the mind. And in a way, that's kind of a lot like what Gonal's doing, because see, and just like a bachelor, by definition, is an unmarried male, but it doesn't tell us whether or not any bachelors exist. A triangle, by definition, has three sides and three angles, but it doesn't tell us that a triangle exists. But what Descartes and Anselm are saying, though, is part of the definition of a triangle and part of the definition of a perfect island, the perfect island, whatever, part of those definitions is not existence. But part of the definition of the most perfect being or the greatest conceivable being, part of that definition, Anselm is arguing, is necessary existence. And so a lot of the objections that are brought to Anselm's argument actually fall by the wayside. I just want to mention a few guys that continue the thought along this line. René Descartes also held to use the ontological argument among other arguments. Leibniz was another philosopher who used it. Spinoza used it, but not to prove the God of the Bible, but to prove a pantheistic God. You go further, and Charles Hartshorne, him and Whitehead used it, and Norman Malcolm. Now, Norman Malcolm really stated it in probably the clearest way that I've heard it stated. And look on page 143, right down at the bottom. Malcolm argued, a necessary being, by definition, is one which cannot not be. Premise number two, that which cannot not be must be. Therefore, a necessary being necessarily must be. Okay? That's probably about as simplified as you can get it without removing too much strength from it. Now, Malcolm did hold that the first form of Anselm's argument, Norman Malcolm did view that as being refuted by Kant's criticism, that basically that existence is not a predicate or not a characteristic or a perfection. It just tells us whether the thing that has the perfections exists or not. But the second form of the argument Malcolm believes is immune from this or any other criticism which he knows. One thing that could be said about Malcolm's argument, it would hold under one condition. In fact, he spells it out at the top of the page where they got the premises with sub-premises under them. That the existence of a necessary being must be either A, a necessary existence, B, an impossible existence, like a square circle, or C, a possible existence. Well, what we know for sure is that a necessary existence cannot be a possible existence. If a necessary being exists, then a necessary being must exist necessarily, not just possibly. If a necessary being exists, a necessary being then must have no chance at non-existing at all whatsoever. However, what the tough hidden premise there in this particular argument is to prove that a necessary being is not an impossible existence. And so Norman Malcolm admits that if you can prove that the concept, a necessary being, is self-refuting, if it's contradictory like a square circle, then it would invalidate the argument. And since we're all limited in knowledge, there's always the chance that somebody's going to come up with some kind of argument which would disprove necessary existence, in other words, disprove the existence of the God of the Bible. And so until we know for sure that a necessary being cannot be an impossible being, it's still not a valid ontological argument. Because to prove God's existence by reason alone, it would mean that the opposite, you'd have to prove with mathematical certainty, so that the exact opposite would have to be impossible. Alvin Plantinga, well, let's save that for a little later. I just want to touch on Immanuel Kant's thought here. We'll look on page 134. Page 134. Immanuel Kant, his critique of the ontological proof. He says that though about halfway down the page, he says there may be no logical contradiction in the necessary existence, but it still may be actually impossible. See, again, keep in mind what Immanuel Kant, he has influenced so much modern thought that very few people do any thinking without using some premises from him. But the realm of the mind, reality as it appears to us and reality as it is, there's a gulf, there's a clear divide that will never be crossed. But anyway, he says, then there is no contradiction involved in rejecting both the idea and the existence, of a necessary being. So, in other words, if it's possible that a necessary being, even if it doesn't make any logical contradiction, if it's just possible that it's impossible for it to actually exist, then we can reject both the idea and the existence of the necessary being altogether. Likewise, there is no contradiction, says Geisler here, paraphrasing the thought of Kant. Likewise, there is no contradiction in rejecting the triangle along with its three-sidedness. Contradiction results in rejecting one without the other. Finally, existence is not a predicate, as though it were a perfection or property that could be affirmed of a subject or a thing. Existence is not a perfection of an essence, but a positing of that perfection. And he closes up this little section here in 135. Hence, existence neither adds nor detracts from the concept of an absolutely perfect being. This has been a standard objection to the ontological argument since Kant.
Couldn't you say that statement, while true of just about anything else, would be false of God? We've made several exceptions in the rules of arguing, since these arguments are applying only to the most perfect being.
Yeah, I have more respect for the ontological argument than Geisler does. I think both Geisler and Aquinas are too Aristotelian and put a little bit too much stock in sense experience. I mean, let's face it, if you just start with both Aristotle's first premise of epistemology, which also became Aquinas's, and hence it's probably Geisler who seems to support it in his works. Geisler states that there was nothing, everything in the mind was first in the senses, except the mind itself. Now we start life as a blank slate. Now if that is the case, that would seem to lead to the Immanuel Kant type thought. Even though you would end up on, it'd be, in one sense, that they're at opposite extremes, because Aquinas just accepted the basic reliability of sense data, sense experience, whereas Kant said we can never know reality as it is, we can only know reality as it appears to us. At the same time, Kant would argue that we couldn't know anything about reality from pure reason alone, and Aquinas and Aristotle and Geisler would argue that you've got to have some sense data before you can start putting anything into the mind. But I think Gordon Clark's objections to that still hold, and I think that I would take more of a Platonic. I would kind of combine Aristotle and Plato there, that at least in the unconscious mind, we're born, created with innate ideas. And though in the conscious mind, we may have a blank slate as we start out life, when we go through sense experiences, it triggers concepts such as the categories that Kant talked about that are in the unconscious mind and bring them to the conscious realm, so that we can draw rational conclusions from sense experience, and we can even make rational judgments of sense experience. It's like Gordon Clark argues that you don't look at two cups the same size and then get your concept of equality. You bring the concept of equality into your sense experience of two cups of equal size and make a rational judgment on it. Clark would also argue along the lines that there's no way to get moral values from a mound of dirt. And so, and even Romans 2, 14 and 15, it seems that God has written on our consciences what is right and what is wrong. Now, as far as Immanuel Kant's dilemma, I think I would favor Gordon Clark and Augustine and Ronald Nash on that, that when it talks about Jesus as the light, and the light which enlightens every man comes into the world, John 1, 9, I don't think it's talking about him enlightening everybody for the salvation message. I think it's talking about Christ in his pre-incarnate state as the Word. It was his job to enlighten our minds. So that, in other words, God is more in our knowing process than we recognize. So in other words, I know that I know that I know that there's a desk right in front of me. But I can't prove it. I can't prove it with certainty. Kant was absolutely right. If you just start with human reason alone, there's a gap between reality as it appears to us and reality as it is. Because if my mind's looking at a photo or a representation of that desk, the only way to see how close it comes to the real desk is to compare it to the real desk. But I never get the real desk, I just get another photo or another representation. So somehow, God has created us in such a way that we come in direct contact with the essences of things. I don't want to get too Platonic here, but somehow God has created our minds so that we can know the real world and the elements in it. At the same time, it goes beyond human understanding how that all occurs. And again, God is more in the process than we see. I'm not saying that God does a separate act for every thought that we have. But it's just like God not only created us, but he sustains us in existence. If he stopped sustaining us in existence for one microsecond, we would all cease to exist totally. But what I do want to... what I say, with Immanuel Kant, because I'm not as Thomistic, although I do consider myself somewhat of a neo-Thomist, I'm not as Thomistic or Aristotelian as Geisler, I give a lot more respect to the ontological argument, although I do not use it in debates and I do not say, tell people, yeah, I think it's valid. On Monday, I think it's valid. On Tuesday, I don't think it's valid. Let me see how much time we got here. We got enough time. I just want to take us back a little bit to Alvin Platinga, scholar from Notre Dame. Their philosophy of religion department at Notre Dame is second only to Barrison's. Basically, what Platinga argues, I've read his book, and so I'm just going to try to summarize it here to save some time. What he basically argues is that to be the greatest possible being, greatest conceivable being, remember with Luis Molina and his all possible worlds, an infinite number of possible worlds, to be the greatest conceivable being means that that being would have to exist in every possible world and would have to be the greatest possible being in every possible world. Then, what's that?
Great actual being. Maybe the possible.
But not only the greatest actual being, but there couldn't even be in that possible world.
Right.
There couldn't even be a being even possibly greater than that being.
Yeah, right.
And it's real. You can do it, but it gets real confusing to talk about the greatest actual being in a possible world.
Yeah.
But you can do it though. The thing is, though, he says, and since, so to be the greatest conceivable being, you must be the greatest possible being in every possible world. And then you should really bring that in the greatest actual being as well in every possible world. Because if there was one world, you know, you have to be the greatest actual being in every possible world. And then since this actual world is a possible world, God must exist, the greatest possible being must exist in this world as well. Geisler argues that Plantinga has hit the nail right on the head, and finally there is a valid ontological argument. However, Geisler says the hidden premise that is snuck in there is the premise that the actual world exists. And once you leave the realm of reason, the realm of possibility, and enter into the realm of the senses and the realm of actuality, which is more actually than the realm of the senses, but once you leave the realm of possibility, the realm of reason, of pure reason, and then go into the actual, in other words, you have to say something exists, the actual world exists, therefore God exists. And Geisler says what you're really doing is you've left the ontological argument, which starts with God and ends with God, starts with pure reason, ends with pure reason, doesn't look at the world at all. And he says they've actually, what Plotinga says, the actual world does exist, therefore God must exist. So it actually breaks down. It's valid, but it breaks down